Well, like everyone else, I'd like to thank Nicholas and Matthias for organizing another fabulous conference, and also, in my case, for the invitation to speak. So I'm going to talk a little bit about some work that I've been doing in a paper last year, and also jointly with my student Manuel Losi, on the large spin limit of the spectral problem matching the spectra on both sides of the ADS-CFT correspondence. Now, I think I gave some very prosaic title to the organizers, and some stage yesterday I suddenly thought of a more snappy title, so the title Giant Holes, and hopefully by the end of the talk you'll understand where the giant holes are, hopefully not in any of my arguments, but rather in a physical analogy which I'll make clear. Okay, so I want to start by thinking about the lowest Regier trajectory of the folded spinning string in ADS, which has played a key role in the development of the subject, starting with the early work of Gubser, Klebanov, and Polyakov that looked at the dependence of the string energy on the angular momentum in ADS and discovered the logarithmic growth in the anomalous dimension, or string energy, which is mapped to the corresponding logarithmic growth in the anomalous dimensions of fixed twist operators on the gauge theory side. So that was an early success. And of course, since then we've learnt a lot more, and in particular we now understand that the prefactor of the logarithmic growth is exactly given by the cusp anomalous dimension. It's leading behaviour at strong coupling scales like square root lambda, but it's one of the great successes of the subject that there are integral equations that determine that function exactly. So I want to focus on an aspect of this configuration, which I think is interesting, and nearby configurations as well. The fact that the string is certainly long, it's long both in the target space and in natural coordinates on the world sheet, its length is essentially controlled by the logarithm of spin, in other words, by the scaling of the anomalous dimension. So we're used to long strings in another context, the context of strings near the BMN vacuum, in the plane wave limit, for example, or the Hofmann-Maldacena limit, which is the limit that gives us the description of the ADS-CFT spectral problem in terms of factorized scattering. So because the string is long, an interesting question is, can we also think about the spectral problem for ADS-CFT, thinking about this large spin limit of the string as a starting point? In other words, we should expect that there, you could, just as in the case of the BMN vacuum, you can think about some asymptotic states which propagate along this string, which carry some conserved momentum, you should expect them to undergo factorized scattering. But as I'll emphasize, these are not the same as the asymptotic states that we're used to thinking about in the context of the BMN vacuum. In particular, they won't be giant magnons. To give the name away, they're going to be something I'll call giant holes. So in particular, what I want to do is present some preliminary results from the point of view of understanding in string theory the semi-classical spectrum of the theory near these long folded strings, in other words, in the large spin limit, and also compare and contrast it with what we know about the gauge theory spectrum of operators in the same limit. So part of the reason this might be interesting is that, as I said, it's starting from a very different corner of the parameter space than the standard large J vacuum associated with the BMN plane wave state. Rather, in terms of spin chains, these are states in general, because we're talking about strings moving in ADS, that are dual to spin chains of fixed length, and therefore they're very far away in principle from the regime where the asymptotic beta ansatz naturally has its domain of applicability, although it's clear that the asymptotic beta ansatz does in fact correctly give you, for example, the ground state energy in this sector, the cusp anomalous dimension. So it also might be interesting to reformulate the spectral problem in terms of a beta ansatz somewhere near this limit in view of our various applications of the spectrum, in particular those applications which are related to string motion in ADS specifically rather than on S5, specifically understanding the connections between the spectral problem and the gluon scattering amplitudes that the previous speaker talked about. And in particular, that relation is actually understood already to some extent, for this folded string itself. There is a relation between the classical solution on the folded string and the Euclidean world sheet considered by Aldea Maldacena. So if we're understanding this in more generality, this seems like a good place to start. So the plan for the talk is extremely simple. Basically, what I'm going to look at is the large spin limit of the spectral problem on both the gauge theory and the string theory side of the correspondence. So I'm first of all going to look at what happens when you take the large spin limit in the one-loop spin chain, in the dual set of operators. That'll be reviewed very briefly. It's mainly the work of Korchemsky and collaborators. And then I want to devote the bulk of the talk to talking about, very simply, a first principle semi-classical calculation of the spectrum in this limit in string theory in ADS, at leading semi-classical order, and also an interpretation of it in terms of some known string solutions. Okay, so let me start with the part which pertains to gauge theory. So, of course, if we're thinking about strings, spinning strings that carry one spin, and they have also, of course, their energy, they have only those two quantum numbers, then the natural place to look for the dual states in gauge theory is, well, in general, in terms of operators that have large numbers of derivatives, but in particular, we're going to focus on this specific SL2 sector where you build your operators out of covariant derivatives projected on the light cone and one of the three complex scalar fields of the theory. So the spin of the operator is just the sum, the total number of derivatives in the problem. Now, of course, if for this audience, there's no need to introduce the fact that we know how to find the anomalous dimensions of these operators at one loop. This was understood in the context of QCD before it was in N equals 4 super Yang-Mills. And the basis is the beta ansatz for the SL2R non-compact spin chain. So what is the basic feature of that? The basic feature is that you think about, first of all, your state as an excitation around the ferromagnetic vacuum of an SL2R spin chain. Associated with each of the magnons is it carries some conserved rapidity. And the beta ansatz equation, so the number of magnons, the magnons are in correspondence with the derivatives, so the number of magnons is the spin, which is going to become large. And the beta ansatz tells you precisely how the rapidities are quantized. And the key feature is that you can interpret the anomalous dimension as just being the sum of the individual contributions to the energy of the magnons. So specifically, we're interested here in a limit where the spin goes to infinity, so that corresponds to taking the number of derivatives, the number of magnons to infinity. But I'm going to keep the R charge, which controls the length of the spin chain, fixed. So it's specifically going to be a large spin limit with J fixed. So, of course, this is the exact formula for the spin chain for all values of the quantum numbers, at least at one loop. Interesting question is, what does that spectrum look like when you take the limit of large spin? Well, it turns out that there's a very economical and beautiful way of reformulating the equations which holds in the large spin limit. You think not in terms of magnons, which are becoming numerous when you take the limit where the spin goes to infinity, but rather in terms of holes in the distribution of magnons. So specifically, magnons are associated with, if you look at the details of the beta ansatz, each magnon has an associated mode number, basically a choice of branch when you take the log of the beta equation. And because of the fermionic nature of scattering in these 1 plus 1 dimensional systems, when you sort of fill up the mode numbers of the state, it's actually like filling up a Fermi C where there is an exclusion principle and you have to fill up, each magnon has to have a different mode number. So in fact, one can make this more precise in the context of what's called the counting function. And there's a way to reformulate the beta ansatz equations. Instead of thinking about the magnons, the number of which is becoming large, instead you think about the holes in the distribution of mode numbers. In fact, remarkably, you can associate a conserved rapidity with each of the holes. And there are some beautiful formulae due to Korchemsky and collaborators, which show that in the large spin limit, you can actually, in a very real sense, think about these holes as the basic degrees of freedom of the problem. In fact, you can rewrite the anomalous dimension as the sum over individual contributions from each of the holes. And I should say an important feature here is that the holes, the number of holes, is always equal to the length of the chain. So it's equal to the R charge in the formulation which I'm talking about. There's a link, in fact, between holes and zeros of the transfer matrix. So this formula works in the same way that the previous formula for the anomalous dimension did. The energy or anomalous dimension is given by the sum of the energies of some individual constituents, and there is this rather bizarre-looking dispersion, if you relation, if you like, for the holes, which gives their the contribution of each individual hole in terms of the corresponding rapidity. In fact, the analogy goes much further than that. Of course, you expect this spectrum to be discrete, so you expect these rapidities to be quantized, and you can actually reformulate the Beta-Ansatz equations as beta equations for the rapidities of the holes. And in fact, in the most general case, they take the form of a nonlinear integral equation, which quantizes the rapidities of the holes. So basically, I want to just use this as a little bit of inspiration for what we're going to find on the string theory side. And I'll need a few facts about the spectrum that you find in the limit of large spin. Basically, when you take into account the fact that these rapidities are constrained by these dual beta equations, if you like, beta equations reformulated so that they quantize the whole rapidities, then one can analyze what happens in the limit of large spin, and you discover that the theory splits up, the spectrum splits up into different sectors, labeled by the number of so-called big holes. It turns out that you always have to have at least two big holes, but you can choose any number between 2 and k, and there will be a sector of the spectrum where that many holes are big. So what do I mean by big? I mean specifically that the rapidity scales like the spin in the limit where the spin goes to infinity. The remaining holes are known as small holes, and they're forced, at least when you're near the ground state, they're forced towards small values of the rapidity. Now, you can work out what this means for the anomalous dimensions from the formula that I just wrote down on the previous transparency. Basically, as you would expect, the anomalous dimension is completely dominated in the large spin limit by the contribution of the large holes. For those large holes, you can take the di gamma function, logarithmic derivative of the gamma function that appears in the whole dispersion relation, and replace it by its large argument asymptotics, which are a logarithm. And then you find the logarithmic scaling that is characteristic of all these operator dimensions at large S. And the integer that sits in front of the log scaling is the number of large holes. So in the ground state configuration, the thing that corresponds to the folded string, that k is 2. But in general, it can take any value from 1 up to j. There is also an order s to the 0 contribution to the energies of these states, which is determined completely by the rapidities of the big holes. So once those are subjected to the Beta-Ansatz, that means we have some function, which I won't try and write down its explicit description, but it's a definite function that comes out of the Beta-Ansatz that depends essentially on the quantum numbers, mode numbers essentially, of these large or big holes. And then if you think about the remaining contributions at lower order in the expansion in large S, the remaining contributions can actually be associated with at leading order. In the ground state, for example, you have the contributions of the small holes, and those are in fact suppressed by 1 over the logarithm of S squared. So that's rather, it's a rather intuitive picture of the large S limit of the Beta-Ansatz. But let me also tell you that there's another way, at least as far as the leading order contribution that I wrote down, effectively the contribution of the big holes, there's actually a much simpler way to analyze the first few terms in the expansion. Rather than starting from the Beta-Ansatz itself, we start with the one-loop spin chain, which you diagonalize with the Beta-Ansatz, and we look at performing the large spin limit directly in the spin chain. And again, this is beautiful work from a few years ago by Korchemsky and collaborators. So the significance of the large spin limit, well, as I said, it's not a thermodynamic limit because we're not taking the limit where the number of z's becomes large, where the spin chain becomes very long. Rather, we're taking a limit where each SL2R representation becomes very excited. You go to a very high excitation number, and that corresponds precisely to a classical limit of the quantum spin chain that appears at one loop. So specifically in this limit, you can take the quantum spin operators that represent the SL2R algebra at each site and replace them with classical spin variables, instead whose Poisson brackets represent the SL2R algebra at each site of the chain. One can look at the same story for the Hamiltonian itself, and then you can re-express that as the Hamiltonian, a nearest neighbor Hamiltonian, for a classical spin chain, a Hamiltonian who governs the evolution of these classical spin variables by Poisson bracket with the pairwise Hamiltonian that I've just written down. So in effect, it's a large spin limit of the XXX minus one half Heisenberg spin chain. So from this point of view, as I said, we're taking a classical limit in the sense that the excitation number is becoming large. So from this point of view, Planck's constant is essentially 1 over S. And a very efficient way to actually get at the leading spectrum, effectively the contribution of the big holes, is to calculate the first terms just starting from this classical spin chain. Obviously, at leading order, you will have a classical degeneracy because it's some classical integrable system. But at first non-trivial order, you will get a discrete spectrum just by applying basic WKB quantization to this classical system. And specifically, what this gives you is the first term, which scales like J log S, basically coming from the fact that the individual spins scale like S. But in particular, you will pick up this function that I talked about, which is a non-trivial function of the quantum numbers that comes from applying the WKB quantization condition to this classical spin chain. So that's a lightning review of the story as far as the gauge theory side is concerned. You have those two ways of looking at things. One is the more precise analysis starting from the beta ansatz in terms of holes, but you also have an analysis in terms of the classical spin chain. Now we want to talk about what the situation is on the string side. And the plan is the following. What I'm going to do is actually perform a quite general analysis of the spectrum, the semi-classical spectrum of strings which carry these quantum numbers. It's rather abstract, and it's going to use the finite gap formalism. And then at the end of the talk, I hope to re-express that in terms of known string solutions. So the plan will be as follows. What we'll do is actually write down the spectral problem, which determines the sort of generic classical string solution in ADS3 cross S1. We're going to include an S1 so that we can include also this quantum number J that corresponds to the length of the spin chain, but we'll ultimately be interested in taking the limit where S goes to infinity with J fixed. So we're thinking about semi-classical strings, semi-classical in the sense of just classical theory plus leading order Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization, moving on an ADS3 cross S1 subspace of the full geometry. So inside that subspace, the relevant quantum numbers, which we identified on the gauge theory side, the energy and spin of the operator corresponds, the enormous dimension and spin of the operator correspond to the energy and angular momentum of the string in ADS3, and the R charge is associated with angular momentum along an S1 direction, which you think of as being part of the S5. So one can immediately simplify the problem by gauge fixing to static conformal gauge. And then, as is well known, the problem reduces to thinking about classical solutions of the SL2R principal chiral model. So in other words, you reformulate your target space ADS3 in terms of a group element that lives in the group SL2R, which is, of course, basically locally the same as ADS3. So one formulates the action not in terms of this group element, but in terms of the Noether current associated with the isometries of the target space. So it's, in fact, the right Noether current. So you can write the action for the principal chiral model succinctly in those in terms of those currents, the light cone components of those currents. So the basic feature in an integrable theory is the existence of an infinite tower of conserved charges. And, of course, for a long time, we've known how to generate this set of conserved charges from the principal chiral model, and this was then understood in much more detail in the stringy context in the work of Benner, Roivant, and Polchinski, which really showed that integrability is a feature of classical strings for the whole ADS5, Process 5 background. But the basic feature is the lax connection on the world sheet that the previous speaker mentioned, and the fact that one can look at the gauge invariant information in the lax connection by taking a Wilson line, if you like, of the lax connection around the world sheet, which is known as the monodromy matrix. And of course, the key thing is that the monodromy matrix and the lax current depend also on a spectral parameter, a complex spectral parameter, and the flatness of the lax current is precisely what guarantees that you have an infinite set of conserved quantities. So precisely the gauge invariant information in the monodromy matrix, the eigenvalues of the monodromy matrix are conserved quantities for all values of this spectral parameter. Okay, so much hopefully is known to most people here. So of course what you can do with this formulation is much more than just writing down conserved charges. As beautifully formulated by Kazakov and collaborators, it gives you an extremely beautiful mathematical way of characterizing essentially the whole classical spectrum of strings in fact, in ADS5 process 5, although I'm interested in the subspace here. So the secret is to look at the analytic behavior of the quasi-momentum. The quasi-momentum was just the thing that appears in the exponent of the eigenvalue that I just introduced here. It encodes the conserved quantities. And this quasi-momentum basically is characterized in terms of its analytic properties in the spectral plane. So this, in fact, is an aspect of the story that has a lot of similarities with the last things that one was talking about, the fact that you can basically formulate the problem in terms of a Riemann-Hilbert type problem in the complex plane, fixing a complex function by its discontinuities across cuts. So the specific thing here is that you can organize, you can characterize the string solution completely by the analytic behavior of the quasi-momentum. In general, it has a series of cuts in the spectral plane, and those cuts correspond to basically zeros of the discriminant in the quadratic equation, which determines the eigenvalues of the lax matrix. They also have, the differential also has specific singularities in the complex plane where the lax connection blows up. And in fact, these are very important. So specifically, the differential dp, which we're trying to find, has double poles, which correspond to the fact that the eigenvalues themselves have essential singularities. And that, in fact, is part of the that's where part of the information that actually string theory is an infinite dimensional system with an infinite number of modes that you could turn in resides. But it's very useful to organize the spectrum in terms of finite gap solutions, which have some fixed number of cuts in the spectral plane. So I'm going to take the case where we have M cuts, and this gives rise to a Riemann surface of genus M minus 1, a hyperelliptic curve. And the spectral problem basically is to find Riemann surfaces and differentials that obey essentially the physical input in the problem, which is various conditions on this data. So specifically, as I've already mentioned, the differential has to have certain singularities. In fact, this is actually a consequence of the Virasoro identity. But most importantly and most intractably, it also satisfies some period conditions on the curve. And these are in general very hard to solve. So specifically, the quasi-momentum is what's called a normalized differential. It has, if you define a sort of canonical set of cycles on the Riemann surface, the A periods of the quasi-momentum vanish, whereas the B periods are proportional to certain integers. Now, those integers have a nice physical interpretation. There's one integer associated with each cut, and if this all looks very abstract, there is actually a nice physical picture behind it. This organization of the spectrum in terms of the number of cuts is nothing other than a nonlinear version of the mode expansion of the string. So specifically, if you scrunch all the cuts down to zero size, you actually go back to the point-like BMN string. And you can think about each cut as corresponding to one of the modes of the string. And in fact, these integers that appear in the period conditions are precisely the corresponding mode numbers. When you're near the BMN string, that's literally true. These are literally the modes of the string. And of course, this basically gives you some way of extending that description away from the linear regime into the nonlinear regime. So it gives you a closed problem for actually characterizing the spectrum. Basically, what you have to do is to find the solution to this problem, organized by the number of cuts. So specifically, we have a bunch of conditions on the differential and the surface we're interested in finding. And in general, what you find is for M cuts, after you've imposed all these conditions, you find a continuous degeneracy of classical solutions. And in general, you can't describe that space in any explicit detail because the period conditions are themselves very hard to solve. But in principle, just counting parameters, you do find an M-dimensional space of solutions, sigma comma dp, for the data of the finite gap construction once you've taken these constraints into account. And once you have a solution that lives in that that solution space, you're almost done, because all you have to do then is to look at the asymptotics of the quasi-momentum to read off the conserved charges, in other words, the spin and the energy of the corresponding string state. So specifically, the asymptotics tell you about delta plus S and delta minus S as you go to X, the infinite point, the point at infinity, and the point at the origin, respectively, in the spectral plane. So this is the first step, to write down a classical degeneracy of solutions. And then the final step, if you want to sort of formally reduce the problem of finding the spectrum to quadratures, up to quadratures at the semi-classical order, is you next need to know what the appropriate Bohr-Sommerfeld condition to impose on this classical spectrum is. For this, in short, you need to know exactly what the symplectic form is on the phase space of the string, and that's a calculation that I did with my former student, Benoit Vicedo. And basically, the symplectic form and its quantization that corresponds to Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization of the string solutions has a very simple and elegant description as a further period constraint on the differential dp, but with this characteristic x plus 1 over x combination appearing also in the integrand. So basically, this set of equations that I've written down, so the Bohr-Sommerfeld condition quantizes the remaining continuous parameters and that makes them take makes these particular period integrals take integer quantum number values, you have a set of equations which then reduces the semi-classical spectrum of the string moving in ADS3 cross S1 essentially to quadratures, assuming you can do this, if you like, independently for each value of M. And if you really want a generic solution, you would probably have to take the M goes to infinity limit at the end. So I should say that this approach to understanding the string spectrum has been very fruitful for comparison with the gauge theory beta ansatz, but less fruitful in terms of actually writing down solutions. As I said, it's rather hard to make direct progress in this formulation because of the complexity of the constraints on the differential dp. So fortunately, we're actually not interested here in the generic problem of the spectrum, but rather interested in the special case of the large spin limit, which is basically the subject of this talk. So one must actually look at what happens to the spectral problem in the large spin limit. And it's essentially this limit that I discovered a nice description for last year in terms of this spectral data. So one can start, let's just for simplicity choose the case where the number of branch points is even. And one can look at the general hyperelliptic curve before you impose the period conditions. And the data really consists of specifying the positions of the branch points. So basically what one wants to do is to take this setup and demand that the spin of the corresponding string solution diverges. And this has been studied for low genus by Korchemsky and collaborators. And also some preliminary results, which prefigure my results, were presented in a paper by Sakai and Sato about this, about what happens, what scaling of the problem occurs when you take when you demand that the spin of the solution becomes large. Well, essentially, you're forced to scale some of these branch points towards infinity to get a consistent solution. So what I'm trying to do here is make a scaling of all the data in such a way that I preserve these period conditions. So that's the constraint on what you're doing. You want the spin to diverge while preserving the normalization conditions on the differential. So it turns out that to do that, you always need to scale at least one of the branch points linearly with S. But in fact, you have a bunch of other sectors where such scalings, similar scalings, can occur for more than one of the branch points. And here I'm actually going to divide the branch points According to the most general recipe that I found for producing large spin limits of the finite gap solution, where you divide the branch points into big branch points that scale like linearly with S and small branch points that scale like S to the zero. And the point of doing this is that you can take this scaling while preserving the period conditions. And in fact, when you do that, you discover that there's actually a very nice simplification in the problem. And it's rather hard to write down in equations what the simplification is, so I'll draw a picture. The basic problem was thinking about a Riemann surface of genus M minus 1 for the finite gap problem, and we had to find this normalized second type differential on this surface. So just the notation here is I have my first Riemann surface drawn as a sort of an abstract surface with a bunch of singularities. So the singularities are the two points in the x-plane, and as it's a double cover, that makes four singularities in all. So the hard problem was to actually find the differential with those second-order poles at those points, which is otherwise a meromorphic differential on this Riemann surface. That involves these transcendental period conditions. So one can look at what happens to the problem in the limit where the spin goes to infinity. In other words, what the effect of the scaling that I just described is. And you can look at what the effect on the period conditions is. And you discover that it has a rather nice and straightforward description in terms of a degeneration of the Riemann surface. In other words, in terms of a pinching of some of the handles, which reduce the genus of the Riemann surface. And in fact, it's a degeneration that takes a very specific form. Associated with a set of big branch points, and if it's not clear, things are always going to be divided into big and small. The holes were divided into big and small. We're going to see the branch points divided into big and small, and also other things, as we appear, will naturally have this splitting into things that scale with S and things that remain order one. So the point is that for the large branch points, you can study the region near infinity and discover that the period conditions go over to the period conditions on a smooth Riemann surface where the differential only has a single pole where it touches the other component. So basically, the degeneration is described by a pinching of two cycles, which factorizes the curve into two halves, and then you have two points where the two components touch. So rather than trying to write out all the differentials in detail, as these objects are essentially determined by their singularities, I'll just tell you what the singularities are. So the key feature of this limit, one key feature is that the four double poles merge into two double poles, and those double poles stay on a genus zero component of the complete surface. And in fact, from the remaining handles associated with the cuts that remain small, you end up with a bunch of extra simple poles for the quasi-momentum on this half of the surface. But essentially, the other part, the part that retains non-zero genus, is simplified technically because you only have to find differentials which have simple poles rather than double poles. So when you look at the eigenvalues, that means they're rational functions rather than having essential singularities. So in fact, this gives you a nice way, essentially, to solve the period problem in closed form. So let me just now describe what the solution looks like and how it's related to semi-classical strings and solutions that we know about in some special cases. So the first special case I'm going to consider is when we don't have any of these extra poles on the genus zero component. Essentially, it's the case where we have the two double poles on the genus zero component. And in other words, that's the case when all the branch points, K is equal to M, so essentially all the branch points are big branch points. I should ask at this point how long I have. Wow, okay. That's better than I usually do. Okay, that's fine. So first of all, I'm going to talk about the case where K is equal to M, so there are no extra poles here, and describe what this means physically. So first of all, I'll tell you the result, and then I'll sort of explain roughly what the physical interpretation is. So it turns out that you can proceed quite a long way with the program that I talked about of semi-classical quantization in this limit, because you can solve the period conditions for the differential explicitly. And what happens is that this piece that factors off, this piece that retains finite genus, something remarkable happens. When you solve the period conditions, it turns out to be exactly the curve, the spectral curve, of the one-loop classical spin chain that I talked about, where the length of the spin chain in that case is determined by k, the integer k. So it turns out that in this degenerate limit, there's one piece of the spectral curve which goes over precisely to the spectral curve that you find on the gauge theory side of the problem. And in fact, that represents a precise agreement between semi-classical string theory and gauge theory in this large spin limit. One can complete the procedure and impose the semi-classical quantization, and what you discover precisely is the following, that you reproduce exactly the spectrum of the semi-classical spin chain which appears on the gauge theory side of the problem. So you reproduce the K log S scaling. I think that was known about a long time ago. But the key thing is you reproduce the order S to the zero piece of the anomalous dimension. And then, of course, there are also many other corrections which are suppressed by, in fact, powers of log S, which certainly don't have a direct matching to gauge theory. But in some sense, you reproduce exactly the contribution of the big holes, but not of the small holes. That's suppressed, and we'll see in a moment that that's different between gauge theory and string theory. So, in fact, this represents a sort of generalization of something we're already familiar with as far as the ground state is concerned. The fact that Essentially, the asymptotic beta ansatz is capable of calculating the correct answer in the large spin limit, even when the spin chain is very short. So that universality has been known about for a long time in the case of the ground state. But now we're saying that actually, up to order S to the zero, generic states agree between gauge theory and string theory in this limit. So the obvious conjecture, if you given the fact that these terms inside the brackets are the same on the gauge theory and string theory sides, is that the prefactor here is replaced, which is square root lambda, of course, in semi-classical string theory, is replaced by the anomalous cusp anomalous dimension, and that then goes over smoothly to the gauge theory answer. Of course, we can't prove that. That's just the most straightforward interpretation of the result. So let me just tell you very briefly what that means in terms of string configurations that you can draw in ADS. So specifically what we've done now is the rather abstract approach to the spectrum where we've really thought about the limit where the spin goes to infinity in the finite gap description. What one can now do is look at specific solutions that are essentially known, compare, calculate their spectral data, in other words, calculate their curves, match them to the results of the analysis that I showed on the previous transparency, and interpret it in terms of semi-classical quantization of the corresponding string solution. So, in fact, the K log S scaling is a clue which was taken on board a long time ago by Kruschensky and other people that the kinds of string solutions you should be looking at in this context are spiky strings where the spikes or cusps of the string start to approach the boundary. There's a very interesting connection there with light-like Wilson loops and with the elementary quanta of the gauge theory, which I won't have time to talk about. In fact, it's not so hard to construct the limiting solutions in this limit. In general, the solution is only known for equally distributed cusps at the vertices of a polygon, a regular polygon. But in the limiting case where the cusps touch the boundary, in fact, even in Kruschensky's paper, you will find essentially the same formula, that you have the K log S piece, and then there are a bunch of moduli which you can associate with the angular separations between the cusps. And in the limit of very large spin, these will become time independent and rotate rigidly. So what our result is telling you is that semi-classical quantization, in fact, takes this function of the moduli and quantizes it in such a precise way, precisely a way which replaces it by this function f. In other words, the appropriate quantization conditions quantize the moduli in such a way that this system becomes essentially identical, at least in the WKB limit, to the gauge theory spin chain. And there's more I could say about that, but I want to make a couple of other points before I finish, so I think I'll leave that. So now let me just talk briefly about some work in progress. Do I have two more minutes? Okay, good. One can also look at the other cases that I talked about, where you have these additional poles on the other component of the spectral problem. So in particular, the simplest case is where you take the genus of the component of the spin chain, or the big hole component, as I call it. You take that to be as trivial as possible. In other words, you take essentially the situation with two big holes or two big branch points. That component of the spectral problem has genus zero. And the remaining component consists of a genus zero surface with a number of poles. whose locations can be varied freely. Those locations are parameters of the final solution until we impose semi-classical quantization, at least. So this kind of degeneration is very well understood in the context of finite gap solutions. Whenever the curve degenerates to genus zero, but leaving you a number of poles, that's generically telling you something about a limit where the string becomes infinitely long, and the poles correspond to individual solitonic excitations that you can add to the sort of ground state of the finite gap configuration. So one can indeed actually try and analyze what the solutions are that correspond to the spectral data that I just talked about. And so what one does, again, is to look at known solutions, calculate the spectral data, calculate the quasi-momentum directly from the solution for these known solutions, and compare them with the spectral data that I've just displayed on the previous transparency. So it turns out that in this case, the spectral data can be matched precisely onto some known solutions. Of course, the basic configuration with no poles is just known to be the infinitely long folded string. But recently, Javitsky and the Brown group have studied different kinds of solitonic excitations which can propagate along the chain, the string. So specifically, there are, in fact, the way they found them is to use the Pohlmeier reduction procedure that Juan was outlining, which reduces the problem to thinking about the Seitz-Gordon equation. And the Seitz-Gordon equation doesn't have any regular solitons, but it has singular solitons, which in Seitz-Gordon language would have infinite energy. But in this language, in the language of the string, the singularity just has the effect of producing a cusp in the string solution. So in fact, one can match the spectral data between these solitonic excitations and the solitonic solutions and the finite gap solution that I showed on the previous transparency. So specifically, the matching is obtained by setting the velocity to 1 over these positions of the poles that I mentioned. And one can compare various other things like conserved charges and show that one gets consistent matching between these two descriptions. So we haven't finished yet, but this should actually be telling us how to quantize these solitons. And when we apply semi-classical quantization consistently, we expect to have some results for the dispersion relation and the quantum leading quantum S matrix for these degrees of freedom. So let me conclude, as I'm running out of time. I briefly described what the semi-classical spectrum of the string in ADS looks like in the limit of large spin. Basically what I've tried to argue is that there are two branches to the spectrum. In fact, this separation into the two halves of the spectral problem that I described corresponds to, if you like, to two branches of states. The branches correspond to big spikes and small spikes. The big spikes are the spikes that point towards the boundary in the Kruschensky type string solutions. And the small spikes are like solitonic excitations which propagate in the background of the big spikes. So these are the specific solutions that I talked about, but the more general case will consist of little spike solitons propagating in the background of the macroscopic spikes that I've drawn in the first configuration. So I believe this has a very strong parallel with the distinction between big holes and small holes on the gauge theory side of the correspondence. And indeed, in fact, as far as the big holes are concerned, you can actually make that map absolutely precise and say precisely what the relationship between the big holes and the spikes are. It's, of course, more interesting and work in progress to really understand the status of these solitonic excitations. But just to finish with, I would like to just finish with a speculation or conjecture that one really should think about them as the continuation to strong coupling of the holes of the spectral problem that you get in solving the one loop spin chain on the gauge theory side. In other words, whereas when we were thinking about excitations around the BMN vacuum, we had giant magnons, in this case, we should think instead correspondingly about what would be called in the same way giant holes. Hence the name of the talk. So there are various things we could do to test this idea, and one thing that is in progress is actually looking if these objects give rise to particles with the right quantum numbers. You can try and quantize the zero modes, and in this formulation you should, presumably if you're really talking about holes, find something that transforms in vector representation of SO6. So I don't have an answer about that yet, but I'd like to finish on that note. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Nick. Are there any questions? Actually, can I ask a question?
I think you have to as the organizer.
I actually really want to know. So, I mean, as you know, there is this ideas now about how to complete the job and find the exact spectrum. I mean, maybe
we even know it,
maybe not. But how do you see, I mean, how do you see the value of these considerations in this context of writing down the final equations for the spectrum?
Okay, sure. So the point is somehow that, of course, we believe that once these TBA equations are finalized, there will be the exact answer. But in some sense, they're starting from the opposite limit, this BMN limit. So you have, in general, a simple description in that language. You go over to your asymptotic beta ansatz in the limit of large J. But of course, the description becomes more and more complicated as you go down to smaller values of J, and there still seems to be some issues about all these finite volume effects. So it may nonetheless, one would hope, for many purposes, be useful to reformulate the whole story. And you expect, based on what happens in other integrable systems, for some reformulation to exist in terms of thinking of these wholes as the basic dynamical variables. So some kind of duality transformation of whatever the exact equations are. And the idea is that this formulation would simplify in this different limit, the limit of large spin. And for many purposes, having a simple description in that limit might be very desirable. For example, as I said, for understanding the relation to things like the O6 sigma model, or understanding the relation between gluon scattering amplitudes and the spectral problem. Or anything that involves strings in ADS rather than strings moving on S5.
Any further questions? So then let's thank Nick again.